Hey guys, welcome to Unpacking Design. I'm Mike LaValle.
And Tim Ung, and this is a show where we tell you about products and ideas that relate to designers all over the world.
Hey, what's up everybody? Welcome back to Unpacking Design. Today, Tim, I have a very exciting topic that I wanted to bring to the show. Are you excited?
I am. Hopefully it doesn't turn out like the Pixar episode.
So I wanted to talk about unpacking speculative projects. And okay. I want to talk about that for two reasons. One, you do a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, I'm going to start doing some of them this summer. And I want to keep this as like a, it's going to be borderline design lifey. So it's in progress or in process. But I want to talk about it just in terms of how designers can do their own speculative projects to build portfolios and things, and also to sort of develop their own design muscles, if you will, in terms of what they're after and what they're searching for as designers.
Yeah.
So I want to start with it by pointing the focus to you because as a person who has just gravitated towards speculative projects, like what made you want to do that in the first place?
So just in case anyone doesn't know, when we talk about speculative projects, we're referring to projects that you're doing on your own, that you kind of come up with on your own, the brief, whatever. Like it's just something that you imagined and you executed on.
Yep.
For me, I used to do a lot of design competitions, both at the end of architecture school. So this is like after 5 years of schooling, I started pursuing all of these architecture competitions. And then after I graduated, I still continued doing these competitions, and I would always work with a team of students.
Sure.
Once I started working with students just in the profession and, you know, like pulling them from the university and kind of mentoring them, I realized that I was doing so many competitions and working on all these different ideas that people were asking for submissions on. And then eventually I realized that I really have topics that I want to pursue on my own.
Right.
And it all started with like this idea of what kind of architecture would I want to design if I could be designing anything.
Sure.
And at the time, it kind of relates to what I'm doing now, but it's not as related to it anymore. But it all started with, and I don't even think I told you this before, it all started with this idea of designing for humanity. Right, it was what kind of issues are out there right now that we have to solve as architects, or that we have the power to solve as architects, from, you know, natural disasters and emergency responses, right? Yeah. So designing houses for those kinds of situations, to designing low-cost housing so that you can start to eliminate the homelessness around the world. Because there are some countries like Hong Kong where people are working very hard and making money,
right,
but even then they don't have enough money to afford a one bedroom or a studio apartment.
Yep.
So how do you start to resolve these issues that I personally would consider a humanitarian issue? And then that spawned into these different design briefs that I would write, or these different ideas from research. And then as I researched more about these causes, especially low-income families and how to design architecture to help resolve that one area, I started to learn so much more about places like New York City and Hong Kong and San Francisco, Chicago, and just this idea in general that people would assume low-income families are low-income because they're lazy, they're whatever. Yeah. In reality, it's not the case. There's a lot of things that limit the income of people. And in fact, a lot of people in America and in other countries are hard workers, just not making a lot of money, because there are others who are making that money through their connections and network and other means. So the research started leading to more architectural ideas, because I started to learn more about why low-income housing works and doesn't work, why we aren't building more public housing, why we aren't having these discussions around the world too. And then that eventually led to me writing a manifesto kind of piece, right? Something that's more like, in New York City, this is what low-income housing has been through the century. And then I looked at every decade within from 1900 to 2010. And I looked at the trajectory of a family making the average income and what they were able to afford back then to the average family today and what they're able to afford today. And then that spawned into this bigger idea of what can low-income housing be?
Yep.
Or it eventually evolved into a bigger idea, which I'm working on now, which is what kind of architecture typology can we start to develop now to combat this kind of humanitarian issue so that we can not only look at these things as low-income housing, but looking at it from the lens of, are we ready for a new type of architecture that people from our society today can potentially live in, like co-living and co-housing?
Yeah.
Right? So then all these ideas started to emerge, right? And as I tackled each one and I started designing for these particular situations, I started designing these architecture projects that I was coming up with. I was like, you know, based on what I learned about this topic, this is what I see as a good solution. Based on what I learned about this particular location, this is what I think can resolve that issue in this country. And then that eventually started to lead to more ideas, because when I finished one project, I was like, oh my God, I have so many more ideas that
sure.
came from that project that I want to apply to this project now. And, you know, these building technologies that I also want to apply, so that we don't use steel, I want to use cross-laminated timber, and I want to start using something that's more sustainable. Then, you know, eventually you start to find a style, I guess, and then the speculative projects just continued from there.
Right.
So that's kind of the way that it happened for me. I don't know if that was easy to follow, but like it's a lot more than that. I just tried to distill it.
No, I think that's a really good sort of framework for one way of developing speculative projects. Like, it seemed like there was a spark of something that you were interested in, and there's like these threads that sort of connect all the projects together, at least in that thread.
Right.
So like, or in that line. So it's that the one topic or the one issue sort of led you to all these other things.
Right. And it's important too. I didn't even realize until you said it back to me, but having an issue that you're trying to resolve was the biggest helpful thing for me, having done all these speculative projects, because you, as a designer, you need an issue to solve.
Right.
You don't just design because you design. You design to solve something.
So one of the, I'm going to come at it from a sort of a different issue that will relate maybe to some of your other projects that don't have as clear of a lineage.
Yeah.
But when I also, and we've talked about it several times, you know, I've also been very interested in design competitions and doing something that was, cool or interesting or something that I thought would allow me to research a certain kind of topic. But I think the thing that I've found for me coming from the opposite end of speculative projects is that I've never necessarily had that one thing that I was very, very interested in.
Mm-hmm.
I've always been sort of curious at a bunch of different little things,
mm-hmm.
or maybe not little, but different things. And, you know, I've designed a facade for a Russian theater in Moscow
mm-hmm.
out of Corian, like, moldable plastic.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've done that, and I've done a lake house, and
mm-hmm.
I've done a skyscraper, and
mm-hmm.
I've done a kitchen interior.
Yeah.
And they all had like their own sort of unique flavor or reason why I did that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always been, for me, the speculative project has been more about what am I interested in the moment, in a way where I'm not necessarily trying to build, like in your case, it seemed like that those projects that you just described
mm-hmm.
where you had an interest in something that research led you to another thing that built upon more research, which built upon a different, like, and then they, you start forking in the road and you start
mm-hmm.
going down these other paths and branching into the other avenues.
Yeah.
Whereas like when I designed, a piece of furniture, it's interesting and I could probably use some of those techniques again for either more furniture or design
mm-hmm.
details or things like that. But I don't always necessarily feel compelled to literally bring one research project and build it into the next research project.
Yeah.
And it's something that I've always kind of liked about what I do, but also
mm-hmm.
kind of been envious of more of like your pattern
mm-hmm.
where you are building a lineage of this and framework to your research where the research actually does compound itself a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really interesting because I don't think until you described that process that I really recognized it as that for myself. Mm-hmm. I've just been very piecemeal and like, hey, this thing's cool. Hey, this thing's cool. Like, yeah. Oh, there's a squirrel. Like,
yeah. Like, see, it's interesting you bring that up because, yeah, I am doing the speculative projects from that perspective now.
Yeah.
But I also have a lot of other kinds of projects that right. I love to do too.
Sure.
So it's not just like low-income housing. That seems to be my passion. Like right. my underlying hobby is like just studying low-income housing. I don't know why. It's probably because I grew up in low-income housing. Mm-hmm. And then as my hobby for architecture, I like to design other kinds of speculative projects too. So I worked on an international lighting competition for an installation in Amsterdam, and I was one of the finalists for out of like 100. I think they had over 10,000 submissions. I was one of 100, then they chose 10. I wasn't selected because my proposal was a little over budget.
Yep.
So for that particular one, it had very little to do with low-income housing. It was just an exhibit that displayed light in a different kind of way. And it was interesting to me because I've always been extremely interested in this idea of diffusing light. So how do you take light and give light form? And that was what that competition focused on.
Right.
Other people did things where they turned light into art. So they took it and they sculpted the light so that it would be like a neon sign, or it would be a boat exhibition where it would shoot mist and then light would hit the mist in a certain way and it would look like a ghost ship. And I was like, wow, it's really awesome too. Mine was all about taking hundreds of thousands of strands of very accurately spaced fishing line, if you would, like something transparent, a thread, that you would then take light either from your phone or a flashlight and you would shine it through. And the moment you shine it through, based on where you were standing, you would perceive the light differently than someone standing even like 1 foot away from you, because mm-hmm. the way it's diffusing would then create a different experience based on the height of the person, based on where they're located, based on how the light is actually refracting through these threads. And then it would actually create this illusion that the light is taking on form. Because of the reflections you're getting from all of those threads, you would see a holographic image of light.
Yeah.
And so they loved the idea, but it was a little over budget, so I didn't move on to like that final build. And the whole idea of the build was actually exciting because it focused on this idea of not just something you build and tear down. The way that we were designing it, because I invited a friend for the second portion of it, it was to design it within a container truck so that you can fold the sides down when it made it on site, and then it would take two containers, put them side by side, fold the sides down, and then the inside of that would be the installation so that you can now move it around the world.
Right.
And it wouldn't be something that you would just pollute the environment with. It would always have a second life. So that was the idea behind that. And then you can start to see the sustainable aspect of my design ideas from there. So then the other competition that I worked on and won, I think, third place for was, it's something no one would even think about. It was for a gentleman in Chicago who I met. He launched the competition to design a sculpture park anywhere that you choose in the world.
Yep.
And this sculpture park was for hip hop. It was for you had to incorporate graffiti, DJing, MCing, and dancing as part of that program. And the idea that I had was to build this concrete structure that was full of the different forms within and outside. And as someone moved through it, it would have slits cut through the concrete throughout the entire piece so that natural light can enter the space, but also from all of the fumes and everything from people spray painting, all of the fumes would be able to escape. And over time, the idea was that more graffiti artists would come here from everywhere in the world, and they would graffiti over a previous person's graffiti art.
Right.
And then this whole place would become an art exhibit of its own. And then inside, all of the walls would be concrete, but it would be constructed in such a way where these walls can now pivot and rotate on a hinge. So that now you can also, as the person designing your piece, you can now to recreate the space by turning walls and connecting them. And then over time, someone would come and unconnect the wall and create something new. Huh. So it was this evolving space. And the last component that we added to it was that all of these slits that brought in light into the building would actually go from every entrance to the center, which was an amphitheater for the performances to occur. And within that same idea of the slits in the rooftop, though it was basically open air so that rain can come in, whatever. But the slits allowed you to then find your way out in case of a fire. So that became the path of egress, so that instead of having a map where you look at it and you say, how do I escape in an event of a fire, you basically follow the light from the slits in the roof out. So then that became another portion where you introduce life safety to this sculpture. So anyway, like, I have all these other ideas. I just happen to love this one area, and that's my passion for low income. So
you've obviously taken several years to get to this point where you're now, this is becoming more and more of like what your direction is.
Yeah.
What do you think, because I know we talked a little bit about competitions before, and I feel like this is a little bit different than that. So competitions might be one method for you to find or try a speculative project, right? I mean, in some ways, the framework is sort of created for you. It's packaged. There's a brief. There's something that like is provided to you, and they give you the parameters. Whereas the low-income housing is more sort of like your passion project now, where you're researching, you're looking for things, you're going down rabbit holes that you are interested in finding more about because you're just interested in knowing the answer to a certain question that you have.
Right.
Is there any other way you can think of that you would generate a spec project? I mean, because I'm just thinking out loud, and this is more kind of brainstorming. Like, for somebody who's looking to just do a project, but they don't know really where to start.
Yeah.
Like, there's competitions. There's just something that you might have a question about. You're interested in finding more.
Yeah.
I mean, the only other thing I could think of is to try like a completely different discipline. You know, or to like try, you know, like for example, you are into crazy amounts of leather working right now.
Yeah.
And it's not like you were trained as a leather worker, but you either through an interest that you had or just sort of stumbling upon it, or another example would be using your laser cutter.
Yeah.
You know, you find these tools or you find these things that just then they create the projects out of that.
Right.
I mean, I know you've talked about that a lot on this podcast, but like how do you start projects when you're learning a completely new thing?
Well, for learning something new, first I start by learning how to do something, right? So like you take the time to learn the techniques behind it and you build that set of tools, I'm going to call it.
Yeah.
The tools that I'm referring to are your skills. So you build these skills so that you know how they can be used. Once you get to that point of like knowing how to do something and you're ready to explore, I start to think about something like for leather working, what is it that I would use?
Sure.
Right? And I start from there and then I think about that particular idea and then I go on to something like Pinterest and I research a product and then I find what's been done, how it's been done, what's the average, what's the typical, and then I look for what's the non-typical. And then from those ideas, I start to evolve it so that it becomes something that I can put my own twist on, you know? And as I think about it, I have to have the knowledge of the skills needed to make that thing because I need to understand what it takes to actually stitch it or what it takes to hide a stitch or to reveal it or where I want to be doing that.
Yeah.
And then it also comes down to accessories. What is the final aesthetic I'm going for? And personally for me, I love minimal aesthetic, so I go for the most minimal kind of things possible. And then I start building from there. So like I sketch it out, I design it, and through the sketches, I actually imagine me making the thing.
Sure.
And as I sketch, I start to realize like, this is not gonna work. And that sucks, that feeling sucks. It's like, okay, I thought this was gonna work out this way, and I spent 10 hours thinking about it, but it's not. So then I take the next hour to like refine it. How can I make it work, right? You start asking these questions, and it's very important to question as you go. You can't design if you don't question. You have to question, and then you have to come to a resolution.
Yep.
So I keep questioning as I'm designing and designing and designing, and eventually when I start making the thing, I always start with a prototype. I never make a product the first time and say, hey, this is perfect, let me sell it.
Right.
The first product is honestly the most crude form that you're ever going to make, but it's the most beautiful because it's the thing that you took the time to learn.
Yeah.
So,
and the thing, just not to cut you off, but the thing that I notice more about the way that you operate is that for you in particular, and this is something that I feel like over time I've lost a little bit of and I kind of want to get back, is you make that one thing or that prototype, and there's a prototype, but there might be other iterations of that before you have something that you're like actually selling mm-hmm. or producing
yeah.
longer term.
Yeah.
That you seem to really get your hands dirty fairly quickly mm-hmm. in the process, like yeah. especially when you're making. And I think that that's also a way to sort of generate, it seems like a way to generate more, sort of like what we were talking about with your other interest in low-income housing, like doing the first version of that mm-hmm. probably gave you more questions that you needed to answer mm-hmm. in whatever you thought the second iteration yeah. was going to be.
Right? That's right. And it's also, this is the biggest thing too for me, it's important to have a sketchbook / journal, because my yep. journal is a sketchbook.
Yep.
Because as I'm designing these projects and I have those questions, I'll write it out. I'll write those questions out. I'll write the idea. And I'll write the idea to expand on it in that moment. Because yep. if you don't write it out, you're not going to remember you had it. So I'll keep those logs going. And then when we get to product design, as I complete that prototype, I then move on to the next step. So then I actually write out what I learned in a journal. Like, this is where I found some failure. This is how I think I can resolve it. And then I sketch out how to resolve it, and then I go and I resolve it. So just to make a very simple, minimal card holder wallet, I went through maybe 10 prototypes because I couldn't figure out how I wanted to do something. And then I had to figure out the final finish details, you know, and all of that is like, there are millions of options out there. And how do you get yourself to choose the right one? And for me, I had to question it, you know, do I want a natural edge finish? Do I want to have a dyed edge finish? Do I want to have black stitching versus red versus the other millions of colors in the rainbow? It's like you have to find these kinds of things. And then for us as designers, we want to pick that one specific hue.
Right.
You're like, okay, out of a million options of yellow, I narrowed it down to 100,000, and now I got to pick one. And then a lot of people struggle with like narrowing things down. But I very quickly find a very, you know, this is what I want. And I make that decision and then I move forward, you know. I don't get caught up in that decision. Because that one decision in the grand scheme of all the other things you have to do,
yep.
if you spend your whole life on that one decision, you'll never finish the project. So anyway, for product design, I go through all those prototypes. Then I make the final product. And then I also ask friends along the way, like, hey, what do you think about this? And you would be surprised at the kinds of feedback you get based on how well you get at describing your project
right.
to someone.
That makes a lot of sense.
In the beginning, I sucked. Like, I would explain a project and I kept getting stuck and I got frustrated because I didn't know how to explain it to a person who wasn't a designer.
Sure.
Now, I explain it exactly as a person would who purchased a product, or a person who is going to have a house would explain that to a friend. Like, this is the house I'm buying, and this is, you know, this is how it's laid out, this is what I like about it, this is what I don't, what do you think? And that's it. Instead of using big terms and weird words and saying, you know, I was playing with form and I was doing this and I was like playing with this and that, and then they just get confused. Like, most people aren't artistic in that sense, so they don't use the terms we do. So feedback's important. And then I think the one area you were going with the speculative projects, which I think is actually a point that I'll stop on because I've been rambling, is
<You're fine. laughs>
in terms of finding a speculative project that's not just about a passionate area you're looking at, because if you haven't found it, you don't have that.
Right.
You have to do something to get there.
Right.
And then if you do competitions, but you're getting bored with it and you're like, okay, yeah. I want to try something else. What I've been thinking about doing now as I move on from this last 30 by 30 project is I will be going into local projects. So uh-huh. looking locally at your city or your town or, you know, somewhere in the world that you care about. You know, maybe you're living in New York City, but you're from Tokyo. And when you find that location that you're very interested in, you learn about its local society and what people are saying about that place or about what they're missing. So if you're a graffiti artist, then you might find a particular neighborhood where you can incorporate your kind of art. And then you can sketch it out on paper. You could find a location and say, okay, I'm very interested in this particular location because there are people who are saying that, you know, from all the previous graffiti, it's actually detracting from the neighborhood and it's inviting crime, whatever. So now as a designer, you might go out there and say, what if I can design a really awesome mural that'll bring people together, something bright, something airy.
Right.
Now you've just found a speculative project. If you're a graphic designer, you might find a particular location or a group of people who need help, right? Like a not-for-profit that you could potentially help in a neighborhood.
Yep.
And then you can reach out to them and say, hey, I'm a graphic designer. I'm working on developing a portfolio of work, and I'm very interested in your organization. And I'd like to help you develop some brochures or some stationery so that you can start to brand yourself better now, too. Now you found yourself not just a client, but a project. If you're an architect like us, especially in Buffalo, I'll use as the example for local stuff.
Sure.
There are so many problems we hear about, right? You have the 198 highway. It used to be a big highway where you could go at like 55 miles an hour. It cut through a beautiful park designed by Olmsted. It's Delaware Park. And there's been so many deaths from people speeding and going off the highway because they're drunk or they fell asleep at the wheel and they would hit a family and kill the whole family. And so people always speed there. So then the resolution that the state put in was, well, why don't we just slow it down? Just put a speed limit thing there and then put a reader that tells people how fast they're driving. Everyone still drives at 55 miles an hour. The speed limit is now 30. And then the Department of State actually hired a design firm or an engineering company to then design a new layout for that highway so that it can be renovated and turned into more of a parkway. No one liked that design because it still allowed cars to drive fast. And it still incorporated that cut through the park. And the neighborhood is constantly speaking out about what they see this becoming, right? They're saying things like, we really want to slow cars down, but we don't even want cars in here. We don't need cars in here. Based on the traffic, the traffic load in this area, we don't need it. We don't need that cut through. If we have to leave it there, why not just turn it into a two-lane street and have stop signs along the way so people can actually cross safely?
Right.
So now you have a neighborhood giving you design cues, and then you have this problem to solve. So you as a designer or as an architect can come to this and say, well, how can I resolve this? You can be any kind of designer. You could be a landscape architect, an architect, an engineer. The same thing with a highway downtown here. They want to tear down the Skyway, which is a highway that basically cuts through, it goes all the way down along the waterfront of the city, and then it basically cuts and it crosses the river.
Yeah, it's called the Skyway because it's elevated like hundreds of feet
elevated,
in the air.
And it's the reason why it's elevated 100 feet in the air is so that ships could pass through and go into the river.
Right.
Well, why is it there? It needs millions, tens of millions of dollars in renovation now because it's so old.
Sure.
And the community keeps speaking out about it. It's not used. It's not a highly used highway. Cars do use it, but it's not highly used. And it's often shut down in the winter because we have crazy winters where the roads get slick and too much snow gets up there and then people slide and then they hit each other and you're high up. You're 100 feet in the air.
Yeah.
So now to resolve this issue of this thing needing maintenance and not many people using it, what can you do there? So now the state is going to put together a competition. But before they do, you could practically go out there and say, as an architect, what would I propose to be the resolution for this? Would I do something like the High Line in New York City, or would I tear it down and turn it into a beautiful waterfront? You know, like, there are cues all around us for design and for speculative projects. You just have to find one that pulls at you.
So this is going to be interesting, and you've possibly answered this already for me, but I think what I want to end the podcast on is a little segment we're going to call Help Mike Find a Speculative Project.
Okay.
So, as you know, I'm developing my portfolio right now, and one of the focal points of it is I'm trying to branch out a little bit in terms of my interest isn't necessarily low-income housing, but it is houses, and it is residential work, and I've done a couple projects that relate to that before. But I guess the question I have for you, since you know me very well in terms of like what my general design sensibility is and what I'm overall kind of interested in, is where would you recommend that somebody like myself start to find, you know, because if I just say house, you know, like that's very broad. That's like probably too broad.
Yeah.
And I'm asking this question partially because I'm personally sketching out, trying to figure out even what my project will be. I just know that I want to refine my skills in that arena and in that program type and in that design area. So do you have any suggestions for somebody like me who's just trying to, like, they kind of vaguely know what they're interested in, but they don't know where to start?
And you
can use me as an example.
I'll use you as the example. So for you, you're working on architecture as your speculative project.
Yep.
And within that area, I do know that you like designing houses or residential, but you like focusing on single family residential based on the portfolio I looked at and, you know, just in general, how you talk about projects and the kinds of projects that you want to do.
Right.
The reason why I think you should start there is because starting at that smaller scale will help you then build if you want to get into a bigger scale.
Right.
Because when you do the smaller scale, it's small enough that you can actually finish it before you jump into the larger one. So when you're thinking about the house, what I found to be helpful when I first started doing speculative projects was finding something that I personally had an attachment to.
Okay.
So for you, it could be designing your dream home, right? Or designing a house that you personally would live in. And then you become the client, which now gives you the opportunity to say, what kind of rooms do you like or need, right? What kind of aesthetic do you go after? Are you a modern person? Are you a postmodern person? Are you a traditional person? Do you like to have decor? And then you start to like get down that line and you can make those decisions quickly because you know yourself. And then it comes down to location. What kind of place do you want this product to be in? Do you like being in a major metropolitan area?
Right.
Do you like being in a forest so that you can have this majestic house that every architect designs?
Right?
Or do you like being over a waterfall? Do you want to have something over a cliff? Are you a rock climber and you want to be on a cliff that you can wake up in the morning and climb down a cliff?
Right.
All right. Like, there's all these different crazy ideas you can have. And that's where it gets exciting because now you can, you can pick anything in the world. It's speculative. You're just making something up.
So maybe maybe the best way for somebody, I'm thinking again out loud, just sort of brainstorming here, but like you were sort of gravitating towards low income housing just because of your personal attachment to it.
I also gravitate towards luxury housing, which is ironic. It's like the opposite end of the spectrum.
Right. Maybe taking that as, it seems like the best way based on kind of what we're talking about is to take the big broad stroke thing, like have at least a general enough focus that like you're at least pointing your focus in a direction, right? And then like almost ask yourself the very big, the biggest questions first, like you were bringing up with me and houses, like whether it's for me or somebody else, like what am I interested in?
Yeah.
You know, and just like almost, I would imagine, like, even if they were like black and white questions that you ask yourself, like you were saying modern or traditional or like, you know, like you're almost like cutting away giant swaths of options that don't have to be relevant anymore.
Right.
And almost like narrowing it down that way so that you're becoming more and more minimalist in the way that you're approaching it, so that at some point you end up at, whether it's, you know, solving some sort of low income housing issue or the Skyway or the 33 or what have you. But I think that's a really good way to sort of approach it because, you know, for me, I know that I would like to just do more of that type. I've done enough variety of different kinds of projects and that has helped me sort of identify that I like residential work and that I like that kind of stuff. So that might be another way to come at it, is like almost try everything, like taste test a lot of different things. But once you find that, you know, sort of narrow it down even more. And I think the thing that's really interesting about the projects that you've done so far is that you have such a refined, like even the way you're talking about it, I can tell that you've researched it a lot, that you've been thinking about it a lot. And even though you're not sort of off the cuff, you know, like with an encyclopedic knowledge, you know, you don't necessarily have to spout like tons of facts and figures. I get the sense that like you have a passion for it, but you've discovered that passion by narrowing down what the topic is, seeing what interests you. You probably reached a bunch of dead ends though too. Like there's been a bunch of things where, you know, it just doesn't work out sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I think the thing that is most inspiring to me about speculative projects is that, like, you can find those dead ends, but because they're speculative, you can also sort of just continue your research in a slightly different direction mm-hmm. and just keep moving.
Yeah. There was a very fascinating quote that I found to be really impactful for me recently, and it's from the Pritzker Prize architect winner, Alejandro Aravena. He gave a quote recently on the Louisiana Channel where he said something along the lines of, architects are authors. And as authors, we have to write and believe in the things that we're designing and making. Yeah. And we have to give it a story. And to me, that's what speculative projects are. You're basically finding that thing that you truly believe in, and then you're giving it life. You're breathing life into it, and it becomes that book that you can give to someone else. And it's something that will live on forever, right? Or until it's demolished or whatever. Mm-hmm. But the idea behind it is that we're not just people who design something and put it out there and say, oh, here you go, this is what you get. We have to start looking at our designs as something that impacts something else in the world. And I think for me, that's why the speculative project stuff really grew on me, because it was something that I truly believe in. It's something that, at least for every product I've designed so far, I can tell a story about each individual one. Mm. And it's a story that goes beyond just the material of the building. It's a story that started with why it began, you know? And I think it's not something you're gonna get to when you first start. But when you design your first speculative project and then you move to the second, and then by the third, you'll have this idea of what it is to you, what it means to design something like a house. And you'll automatically know that certain decisions that you previously questioned for 10 hours, you can now question in 5, then 1, then 10 minutes. And then the bigger questions that come up are more based on a unique situation that you're placed in because of a new location, a new project. So it's something that you keep learning from. And if you don't do speculative projects, you start to lose that. You know, I think to end the episode, I think it's actually important to just briefly talk about the fact that a lot of designers graduate, enter the profession, and they just do their 9-to-5 and they leave and go home and have their life, which is fine. But if you are a passionate designer who really wants to, like, put something out into the world that you truly believe in, and that you want others to follow and to, like, believe in with you and to create this group around, then you have to start finding that thing that you truly believe in. And then you start to confidently express it to other people, and you start to share these ideas through your work. And hopefully that'll lead to something more for you, whether it's a client that sees it and reaches out, or it's someone who was so inspired by it that just wanted to show it on their blog or in their book, or they just wanted to interview you about it. And it's something that gives you motivation to continue doing what you entered the profession for. And I find that a lot of people lose that when they work their 9-to-5s and they don't enjoy what they design. They don't see what they used to see. You know, that's why I pursued the speculative projects, because I never wanted to lose that side of design. Never wanted to lose the reason why I got into it, you know, to resolve problems around the world, to try and do something that is not just guided by a client telling you, I want, I want, I want, but doing something that's more about how can we do something better? How can we make something that people will enjoy and that people will appreciate? So
I don't know if I could have said that better. So I think we both agree that speculative projects are, I think, not only beneficial to the person who's doing them, but they can be, as you said, depending on which way you approach them, they can be very beneficial if you're solving a problem for somebody else. Mm-hmm. And going out in the world and trying to find those problems to then try to solve them as designers, I think, is a very noble pursuit, and I think something that we should do more of.
Yeah.
So,
all right, guys. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Hey guys, thanks for listening to another episode of Unpacking Design. And you can check us out anytime at the unpackingdesign.com website.
And you can also find us on iTunes and anywhere else that you listen to podcasts. Please remember to leave a review and share this podcast with someone you know.